Good morning. I hope you guys all had a wonderful weekend. I'm really glad to have you here. We're going to continue on talking about the different groups on the periodic table. We looked at group 1A at the end of Friday with a fun little video how they all react with water. Although that video might have been a little overblown, it was still fun. You can see they're very reactive with water. And now this group, group 2A, is the alkaline earth metals. And I just want to review real fast. On the periodic table, the groups go top to bottom. So we looked at 1A at the end of Friday, and we're now on group 2A right here. Group 1A, does anybody remember what their name was? Alkali, right on, that's right, alkali metals. Group 2A, right next door, these are the alkaline earth metals. And those are two of the names I'd like you to kind of know, because we'll talk about them a lot. Groups 1A and 2A, and also on the far right, groups 7A and 8A, the halogens and the noble gases. Those names are in common use and stuff, so it's a good idea to at least know what they are. We'll see some other funny names here in a little bit for groups 3A and 5A. They're kind of neat to know, but they're honestly just for your own information. But anyway, the alkaline earth metals, magnesium, calcium, barium, those kind of things and stuff. Anyway, this is an example of a video, I didn't show it now because we watched it the other day, of magnesium, which burns in air to make magnesium oxide. So magnesium's kind of a nice metal. The oxide becomes kind of a powder. And you can see on a chemical level how these things transform. And we'll talk more about that kind of stuff in Chem 222. Beryllium is a group 2A, but it's a lot different than the other ones. Beryllium's actually pretty toxic, so you need some really special kind of techniques to deal with it. It's also not as abundant as a lot of the other group 2As, which is interesting. So, group 3A, right next door, the fancy name, icosagens, boron, aluminum, gallium, indium, and thallium. Aluminum is really common in the Earth's crust. It's used a lot and stuff. So there's a lot of uses for aluminum. Boron, definitely, really important for us, both biologically and industrially. Gallium is kind of an interesting one. Gallium, officially, at room temperature and pressure, is a solid. But if you even hold it in your hand for a little bit, it begins to melt. And so some old periodic tables actually listed gallium as a liquid. But apparently they think now that it is a solid at room temperature, but if you just add a tiny bit of heat, it'll turn into a liquid. Chemists used to, in the early 1900s, late 1800s, they made spoons of gallium. And the spoons that people would like, oh, here, put some sugar in your tea or cream or whatever, and stir it up, and then the whole spoon would like disappear. Ha 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 ha. Hopefully they didn't drink it.
Because. What is the scientific room temperature?
So that's another part that varies. It might be warmer in, you know, Tahiti than it would be in Nome, Alaska and stuff. So usually like 22, 23 Celsius and stuff. So I don't know off the top of my head what the exact melting point of gallium is and stuff, but it's very, very close to those kind of numbers. Cool. Other questions? Crystallogens, I think is how it's pronounced, I never use that word either, is a very disparate group of elements. Carbon, and definitely silicon, are very important non-metals. But the bottom ones, tin and lead, some of the most important metals. So group 4A is a very different group of elements. You have different properties if you go from the top or the bottom. Carbon, definitely crucial for us. All of our DNA, a lot of the things we eat, caffeine. Anyway, all these things have carbon in it. Now, pure carbon exists in different forms, and we'll talk about that in the next section. Diamond is one form of carbon, which everyone's familiar with. It's a very intricate structure. It's also a very hard structure. But there's also graphite, and we'll see that later. Silicon, though, is big time important as well. There's definitely differences in eruption of volcanoes, depending on the type of silicon you have inside of it. This is one form of quartz. We'll talk more about these a little bit as we go through.
To get to the heart of the global warming story, the very heart of it, you've got to look past lonely polar bears and past melting glaciers and past the changing climate, because behind the scary news and the very scary Hollywood movie It turns out that the scientific explanation for global warming depends to a very large degree on one particular atom. The atom that we call...
Carbon.
The more you know about this atom, the more you're going to know about global warming. First of all, it's everywhere. The lead, we call lead in the pencil, it's not lead, it's...
Carbon.
Diamonds.
Carbon.
You.
Me.
Yeah, you. You are mostly water, but if I squeeze you like a sponge... Your dry weight, what's left of you? You're about two-thirds carbon.
Great. Carbon's great, but can I have my everything else back? Please?
Yes, carbon is the central element of life. So much so that everything that is alive, and I mean everything, from an amoeba to a whale, from a dandelion to a redwood tree, in fact, inside every cell, in every creature bar none, you will find
carbon.
And why?
Yeah, why?
Because as the science writer Natalie Angier says, carbon is the duct tape of life. It stitches living things together. Carbon atoms are built to attach, to grab on to other atoms. They have, as you see, four points of attachment, and they love attaching. They can form jungle gyms. This is the inside of a diamond. They form sheets. This is graphite in a pencil. They form spheres. They are very social, which is why they are so suited to living things. Living things, after all, come in all kinds of shapes, and carbon can make them all. But it's carbon's special ability to grab on, to grasp other atoms, that is now getting us in trouble. What starts down at the atomic level can, if we're not careful, lead to big, and I mean very big, problems.
So this is just a quick overview, part of a video from a PBS series on carbon. And you can see a little bit there what's going on. I want to talk about the chemistry of carbon. Carbon does have four points of attachment, and we'll talk about this more later this quarter. And it attaches with just about everything, especially the nonmetals. So it can attach with hydrogen, and it can attach with chlorine and bromine and stuff like that. But just probably like you have a type of food that you prefer more than others. So for example, with me, it's pizza, can you tell? Anyway, in my case then, you start grabbing for the things you like and you don't want to give them up. And in carbon's case, their pizza, if you will, is oxygen. So you start ending up with a lot of carbon that can make two connections to each oxygen. You end up with a lot of CO2. So carbon dioxide begins to build up, and carbon really likes oxygen. It's not real happy sometimes to get rid of oxygen and reform to hydrogen. And that's what leads to problems with CO2 and stuff like that. So anyway, we'll talk more about a lot of the chemistry that we saw there in upcoming sections, but it does give kind of a nice overview of what's going on. Now the peptidogens is the next group over. Most of these are more nonmetals, and the first three very important nonmetals. Nitrogen, very important to life, just like carbon. Phosphorus, arsenic. Antimony is a metal / metalloid. I think it's more metal than metalloid. And bismuth is actually one of the heaviest metals, which is kind of exists and doesn't decompose, and we'll talk about that later too. Of all the nitrogen compounds, the one that we're going to talk about a lot is called ammonia. And ammonia, which has kind of a powerful smell, it's used in smelling salts and things like that. It's nitrogen connected to three hydrogens. We're going to see this a lot. There's also an ammonium, which is different than ammonia, and we'll talk about this. But in the back of your mind, if you can think about ammonia as NH3, it'll make some upcoming things we're going to talk about good. Now, phosphorus has a couple of stable forms. There's not just like one form of it. White and red phosphorus are very common. But what's really interesting to me about phosphorus, this poor guy named Brandt, 1669 was the first to really isolate phosphorus, which is really cool. However, the reason he used it, he was more of an alchemist, I would argue, than a chemist. And alchemists thought that things that were golden probably had gold in them. And of course, gold is really valuable. So he took a lot of urine, I mean gallons of urine, and he isolated it down. He found phosphorus, woohoo! He didn't find gold, obviously. Anyway, most chemists today don't have to do those kind of demanding jobs. But anyway, this is supposedly a picture of him in his old alchemical laboratory. Anyway, next one over the chalcogens, group 6A. Group 6A has oxygen, sulfur, very important non-metal. Selenium, very important for our life, we need some selenium. Tellurium and polonium, not as common stuff, but really good. Sulfur is actually all around us. And again, in geology and a lot of natural biological functions, sulfuric acid is part of things and stuff that has sulfur in it. All right, chalcogens is a strange name, but let's talk a little bit more about oxygen.
Today, students, we're going to learn about oxygen. Element number 8, atomic mass 16, and an ambitious young student in element theory school. It's time for recess. Let's observe as oxygen tries to make friends on the playground. Here's helium, all alone on the carousel. Not having much luck, is he? Perhaps oxygen can give him a hand. See that, students? Oxygen repels helium, much like a magnet. Looks as though helium has gone off to play somewhere else. Seems here that oxygen has made friends with iron. It's unfortunate, however, that they won't be able to play on that seesaw for long, since oxygen causes most metals to rust. Someone should get the nurse. Oxygen has recovered quickly from his little bump and can now be seen playing with barium. But they should be careful playing in that rocket, since oxygen is often used as ignition in engines. Curiously enough, barium is also used in fireworks, which produce a brilliant green hue. Don't be sad, oxygen. Maybe hydrogen can be your friend. See? Nothing bad will happen. That is, unless a second one jumps in.
H2O is water.
That's it for oxygen. Be sure to watch our next lesson where we investigate the effects of helium in the upper atmosphere.
So this little silly art house video thing actually has some really cool chemistry in it, because helium is actually small enough that the Earth doesn't hold it down by gravity. So helium does actually go up into the atmosphere after a while. And also, as you can see, oxygen with barium is sometimes oxygen's a fuel. Barium does make a green color in fireworks. The formation of water, rust. Anyway, it's actually kind of cute and stuff how they did it. It's kind of cheesy, but anyway, oxygen is also very social, like carbon. Carbon likes to have 4 connections. Oxygen usually has 2, and we'll see it. And also, oxygen and helium were repelling each other. They both have a lot of electrons, and this is something else we'll see when we start making bonds and stuff. So, poor little helium. Anyway.
The reaction of sodium and chlorine is a vigorous one. We use sand to protect the flask from excessive heat. Then, we fill the flask with chlorine gas. Next, we add sodium. And then a few drops of water to activate the reaction. The reaction produces sodium chloride.
Now, somebody last week, might have been Blake, but I'm not sure, somebody was talking about how if you take pure sodium, which we saw on Friday, reacts with water, all right? You try and eat a piece of sodium, your body's covered in water, all right? Not good for your body. You try and take in some chlorine gas, all right? This was used in World War I as one of the horrible gas agents in the trenches and stuff. Chlorine would also kill you, not good. However, you react sodium and chlorine, and that's what this reaction's all about. A lot of energy is given off, you end up with sodium chloride, table salt. And we use sodium chloride like every day and stuff. You can get a little bit and stuff in your diet. So it's amazing sometimes how these horrible compounds, if you were to try to use them in your body anyway, these horrible compounds end up with something that's very benign and arguably to a point good for you. Don't want to do too much sodium, etc., etc. This is the joy of chemistry. Sometimes the things that you create completely different than what you started with. So the halogens, very important group of nonmetals. All right, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, iodine, used all the time. We'll focus especially on the middle three, although fluorine is also really important. Astatine is more radioactive, not as common stuff, but there are some interesting uses for that too. And by the way, I should remind everyone that I'm using here on the periodic table what I consider to be the American designations for group numbers. And that's what we have on the periodic tables in this room. The American quote-unquote version has 1A and 2A on the far left, and it has 3A through 8A on the far right. There is an international version as well, which literally lists the columns from 1 through 18. If you're using the international version, like for example, group 7A would be group 17. And they're both fine, it doesn't matter. There's reasons why I'll use the American version, and I'll talk about that this week in lab. But anyway, if you do have an international version, it's totally fine to use, just realize there's some group number differences. So there's reasons for both. The group 8A group, or group 18, international version, those are the noble gases. And noble gases used to have a different name. They used to be considered the inert gases. But in the 50s and 60s, people started making compounds with these gases. At first they thought, oh man, no one can make anything happen with them. But scientists are pretty smart sometimes. They made some krypton and also some xenon compounds. This is an example of one of my favorite ones. It's a xenon in the middle with an oxygen and four fluorines. And we'll talk more about what this is. The noble gases, of course, are great gases, though. Helium and neon are lighter than air, like we saw in the problem set last week. The other ones are heavier, and that can have some uses as well. My favorite group on the periodic table, though, is the group that's kind of in the middle. So in the quote-unquote American version, it's the B groups in the middle. And these groups in the middle, usually it includes the bottom two lines of elements that go across. Now officially, this group in the middle here in the red box, officially those are the transition metals. And the metals are very reactive. They have different types of states they take. Iron 3 oxide is an example of a transition metal. Iron is right about there on the periodic table. The group below, which are two lines and stuff, sometimes those are also referred to as transition metals, but the better term for them are lanthanides and actinides. The lanthanides are the first row that goes left to right, and the actinides are the second row. And both of them have different uses. The properties of transition metals, lanthanides and actinides, are a little different than the groups on the far left and the far right. So in the American version of the periodic table, that's why you have A's on the left and right, and the B's kind of are in the middle. There's a reactivity difference that we'll start talking about this week in lab. But as I said on, I think, the first day, one of the reasons that I went into the type of chemistry I got into was because of the colors, all right? And it's totally dorky. But in organic chemistry, which is the chemistry of carbon and nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, stuff like that, usually things are white, black, and if you're unlucky, brown. But in my world of transition metals, wow, are there a lot of colors, all right? You can just see them and stuff like that. And I used to work with these compounds that were just an intense purple, and they turn into blues and greens and stuff like that. And anyway, that for me was important. Go figure. Anyway, but in my world, that was something that was kind of cool. And so you do see the really neat colors in the transition metals. And it's not that all of the transition metals have colors. Like, there's an example of one that doesn't. And it's also true that not all organic compounds don't have color. You totally see them. However, in general, the transition metals have some pretty intense kind of things. So that's kind of the end of this particular chapter. All right. We kind of looked at what the atoms are all about and stuff like that. Now what we're going to do, though, is get more into the compounds. And the elements are really fun, all right? Like, the things they can do are really neat. But what we're going to do now is we're going to start really looking at what you can do with them. It's fun to have a big Lego set where you have, you know, pieces with like 8 little holes or little 4 holes. But what you build with the Legos is even more impressive. And a couple months ago, I was in a Lego store and they had a big R2-D2 that someone wrote or bit. And I was like, whoa, that's pretty cool, all right? That's kind of where compounds are related to the elements. I mean, the elements are awesome, all right? Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, even iron, whatever. However, the compounds that are created are pretty neat. So what we're going to do now is we're going to start seeing how you take those elements and you make them into compounds. And of course, here's the early chemists. Okay, this is stupid, but anyway. But first, a little poetry. Auntie Jane fed to baby Nell what she thought was calomel. What the baby really ate was corrosive sublimate. Not much difference, even I must confess. Just one chlorine more and one baby less. Oh! So anyway, calomel and corrosive sublimate are both compounds with mercury and chlorine. But one of them is just one mercury and one chlorine, and the other one is one mercury and 2 chlorines. So if you give HGCl, it's okay. That can actually be helpful and stuff like that, prevents diseases and stuff. But oh man, the other one, HGCl2, big difference. It's a toxin, man, it'll kill you. So the reason I bring this stupid poetry example up here is not to impress you with my Walt Whitman skills, obviously, but I want to show the difference between just one atom, all right? One chlorine, 2 chlorines, good for you, arguably, bad for you. Let me share a joke with you in case my poetry didn't get through. I've said this to some of you already, and I apologize, so you're going to hear it again. 2 chemists go into a bar. All right? And they say, I would like to have some H2O. I'll have some H2O too. All right? The good. Barbara's already sees it. It's so cheesy, I'm sorry. So you get 2 liquids. They look the same visually. You can't tell the difference. One of them, yeah. Other one, ah. Okay, really bad graphics. All right, totally cheesy. I don't know where I ripped it. I mean, someone gave it to me. But anyway. H2O is water, H2O2, hydrogen peroxide. Looks just like water, you pour it out, you're not going to be able to tell the difference. You don't want to drink that, man. If you've ever had a cut that someone applied H2O2, it kind of stings and stuff like that. It's a good source of oxygen, and we'll talk about that in a later class too. So one oxygen difference, again, makes a big difference, just like one chlorine can make a big difference. So if I said to Barbara, I said, hey man, go get me some hydrogen oxygen, all right? She'd go back and she'd see, you know, like water, H2O. She'd also see hydrogen peroxide, which is H2O2. They're both, quote unquote, hydrogen oxygen compounds. And she'd come back and say, hey Russell, which one do you want? And she knows that there's a big difference between life and death, basically, let's be honest. So as chemists, we have to have a way that we can talk to each other about these, all right? So that we do have the right compound. You want to be this person, probably, and not that person. Idiot. Okay, I don't know where this came from. Maybe this isn't appropriate. Sorry. Anyway.
But actually, if you drink it in just drops, it breaks down into more oxygen and can be helpful.
So you have to have a pretty dilute solution. And the kind of things we have in the lab are not the dilute solutions. No. But you're right. Small amount.
Under doctor supervision.
Be very careful would be my recommendation. But I'm not a medical person. What can I say?
Just to piggyback on Barbara's comment, There was a therapy in the 1970s that was hydrogen peroxide therapy, because they said if they put an extra oxygen molecule in your body, it would super oxygenate you and kill the free radicals that were in your body. But I think it's called food grade.
Okay, that would make sense. That would make sense, Fran. Hydrogen peroxide can introduce the radicals you're trying to avoid, too. So I would be, as a chemist, very hesitant and stuff like that, but sometimes my perspective is weird, too. So just, I would tell you to wear safety glasses, but obviously this wouldn't help in this case. So just be safe, kids, all right? So. Let's move on. Compounds are combinations of other elements. And if you get down to an individual piece of the compound, that's what a molecule is. So this is an example of a methane molecule, all right? Methane is basically the natural gas you use in your house, if you have it. These gas outlets are essentially methane. They have some other stuff in them too, but it's mostly methane. So if I took all of that methane I just released right there, and I isolated one part of it, that would be a molecule of methane, but most of the time, the compound of methane is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with lots and lots of pieces. Now, it comes in different forms. Some compounds will have metals in them, like sodium chloride, we talked about earlier. Some compounds do not have metals in them, like CH4. And there's a difference, as we'll see, between how these compounds come together. Also, you'll see variations of elements, too. So carbon is an example of an element that has more than one form. This is buckyball, right, which is the informal name, which is 60 carbons. This is ozone, which is different than the oxygen we breathe. So we'll talk about all these kind of things as we go along. Also, an ion, we're going to see, is something that has a positive or a negative charge to it. And that's another player in these. A lot of times these radicals that we talked about a second ago, a lot of times the radicals will have a charge with them as well. And that's a whole other level of excitement. So again, a compound is nothing more than this, than two or more elements coming together. And the other important thing is that it's always a definite ratio by mass. Water is always two hydrogens to one oxygen. All right, you'll never see like two hydrogens to three oxygens or something like that. Always two to one hydrogen to oxygen. And the elements that form the compounds, a lot of times you totally change their properties. So we saw how sodium and chlorine, which would both be very, very deadly to us if we took them straight, become sodium chloride, which you sprinkle on your French fries if you eat that kind of stuff. Those kind of things are all right. So a lot of times what you make, totally different than what you started with. And if you break any of these down to the smallest unit, you'll have the molecule. So if we had a big pile of sodium chloride and we split it into two sections, I'd have a smaller group of sodium chloride, smaller, smaller, smaller. I'd finally get down to a molecule of sodium chloride. That's like the smallest piece you can have. And you can break a molecule into the elements that came into it. So it's possible to break sodium chloride, for example, get back into sodium metal and chlorine gas, but it won't be the compound anymore. You're going to have totally new things at that point. A formula for a compound is something we need to talk about. And what they'll usually do is they'll try to condense the formula down to something that's more manageable. This is the formula here for glycine. And you'll sometimes see C2H5NO2. So notice that we're now going to start using the lower right-hand subscript location. Earlier in the last section, we saw how the lower left side subscript, that was the atomic number, the number of protons. The upper left-hand number, that was the mass number, protons plus neutrons. But from here on in, we're going to be a lot more interested in the right-hand side of the element. So if you see a subscript 2 next to the carbon, that means you have two carbon atoms. And here we have 5 hydrogen atoms, 2 oxygen atoms. But notice that we don't put a 1 by nitrogen. If you see the element listed in a formula, it's implied that you have one atom. You don't need to put N1O2. It's implied that it's 1. Now, through spectroscopy and different types of techniques, This is what the glycine molecule looks like. And sometimes what people will do is they'll use a color-coded system to tell you where the atoms are. So a lot of times in these formulas, carbons will be black, the hydrogens will be white, oxygen a lot of times is red, and nitrogen a lot of times is blue. Not all the time, the colors change and stuff, but this is what it is. Now, because glycine on an atomic scale looks like this, you'll sometimes see glycine written in other ways. So notice this new form that's listed right here. This form kind of looks like the way the glycine's put together. Like the NH2 is on the end, then there's a CH2, a CO, and an OH. So sometimes if you see them kind of spread out like that, there is a reason for it. It's trying to give you a hint as to what it quote unquote looks like on the atomic level. Most of the time, we'll have them listed like this, but if you do see it spread out, just realize that they're trying to give you a hint as to what it's looking like. Now, this is the very best way to represent a molecule. It's got some angles, it's got some three-dimensional structure that we look at, but a lot of times, of course, when chemists are writing reports or emails to each other or whatever, all right, this isn't a very practical way to talk about the molecule. So you'll see sometimes these molecules like flattened out, which is what we have right here. So here's the NH2 again, here's CH2. Don't worry about this, this is called a double bond between oxygen, but that's something that exists right there. But again, you'll also see a lot of times it just listed like this. So what I'm trying to show you in these slides is that a formula is sometimes listed in different ways. Most of the time, we'll have this kind of version where all the atoms are condensed down. But definitely in Chem 222, when we'll look at why these molecules take on these kind of forms, sometimes you'll see it like listed like this or this. Just be aware that there's different ways, but they all are representing the same thing. And even if you saw this kind of formula, you could translate it back into a C2H5NO2. Just look at the colors, figure out what the key is. So glycine, here's three ways to represent it. Again, what chemists, I think, generally prefer is something like this, which is sometimes referred to as a ball and stick model. This is a drawing of glycine with a two-dimensional system, which is okay. But in reality, these atoms, they snuggle up next to each other. There's not this nice like distance between them. So right here, we have the nitrogen and the two hydrogens, and the nitrogen next to the oxygen. You can see there's an overlap, like you don't see like a nice sphere. Really, in an electron version, this is what we're gonna see. Physical chemists, people that do physics and chemistry, prefer space-filling models, but honestly, it's hard sometimes to figure out what's going on. If you see this kind, just realize that somebody was trying to be cool. These in this way are easier to tell the formulas, but when it comes to bonding, sometimes it's not. Now, after all this, you probably want to think about ethanol, drinking alcohol. I mean, no, if you're under 21, root beer, right? But seriously, bad jokes aside, ethanol is the active ingredient in alcohol, all right? So that's where my bad joke comes from. Now, ethanol is a CH3CH2OH. And these are just different ways to represent it, all right? Both of these, of course, are three-dimensional, which is definitely a cool way to do it. This is kind of a smashed version of the ball and stick into a two-dimensional matrix. We'll talk about this more as we go through. Now, because of all these different ways, we need to talk about different ways that scientists use to represent formulas. So I'm going to show some examples here, and we're going to talk about a molecular formula, an empirical formula, and a structural formula. So water, as you probably know, is H2O, two parts hydrogen to one part oxygen. The molecular formula literally is H2O. It says that you have two hydrogens for one oxygen. Now, the empirical formula, that's the smallest whole number ratio of atoms. and you never want to go to fractions. So if it's 2 to 1, I can't make that 2 to 1 fraction smaller without going 1 to 0.5. Chemists generally hate fractions, as we'll see. So in this case, empirical and molecular is the same. We'll talk about why that's important later. But really, as you maybe saw in that video, when oxygen had two hydrogens, really oxygen has a hydrogen, quote unquote, to its left and to its right. So really, in a structural version, it looks more like an HOH than anything else. It's not hydrogen, hydrogen, oxygen. It's always hydrogen, oxygen, hydrogen. So you'll see water listed sometimes like this. The chemists are trying to give you a clue, like how it looks in the real world, in three-dimensional space, but it is still H2O. Now, earlier we talked about hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, all right? Hydrogen peroxide actually has the two oxygens in the middle, and hydrogens are out the outside. A lot of times, hydrogen likes to be on the outside of things, we'll see. Notice here now the molecular formula, H2O2, is different on the empirical version. Empirical version here is one hydrogen to one oxygen. So if you divided both of these numbers by 2, you would get one hydrogen to one oxygen. Empirical versus molecular formulas will be something we'll talk about this section, and that's why I'm introducing it. Here you don't want to go to 1 to 0.5, stay away from fractions in chemistry. But 1 to 1 would be okay. Ethylene, ethane, ethanol, and dimethyl ether are more just examples of things I want to show you. Ethylene is what makes bananas go brown. There's another way in front, I can't remember. The formula is C2H4. This is what it looks like. But the empirical formula, in this case, instead of 2 to 4, would be 1 to 2, CH2. Ethane, C2H6, which is a fuel like methane, it has an empirical formula of CH3. This is what it looks like. Here's an example of ethanol. Ethanol is C2H6O. You can't make that go any less. This is the drinking alcohol. But I bring ethanol in because there's another compound, dimethyl ether. Dimethyl ether has the same types of number of atoms as ethanol. And you can't tell, based on molecular or empirical formulas, what's going on. You need to know what the compound looks like in order to differentiate dimethyl ether and ethanol. So I bring this out to show that each one of these representations has a use for it. All right, we're going to be mostly concerned with molecular and empirical this particular section. Later on, that structural thing will come to play. Yes, absolutely. There's some groups that have OH that aren't alcohols, but yeah, all of the alcohol groups have the OH and stuff on the end of them. We'll talk about that more in Chem 222 for right now. Good, yeah. No, 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 that's awesome. See you in the future, man. Respect. Let's say we have P4O10. By the way, I fixed the eye clicker. It's no longer stopping really fast. Sorry about that the last week. Technology. Anyway, P4O10 is a type of a phosphorus compound. It makes a kind of a, when phosphorus is ignited, it makes a bright light and stuff like that. What would be the empirical formula? Now, when it comes to empirical formulas, you always want to have whole numbers of atoms. You never want to have fractions. So if you divided both 4 and 10 by 4, all right, you'd have 1 phosphorus, 10 divided by 4 would be 2.5. But again, chemists really don't like fractions, so you want to try and stay away from them. So in this case, if you were to divide both of these by 2, P4, 4 over 2 would give you 2, 10 divided by 2 would give you 5. In my world, the empirical formula would be P2O5, 2 phosphorus atoms for every 5 oxygens. And it's not that this is a, quote, a mathematically incorrect empirical formula, it's just that in our world, you're going to see, you want to always have whole numbers. So P2O5 would be the chemist's empirical formula, if you will, for P4O10. Yeah?
You can't cut an oxygen in half.
Exactly. That's an ex- excellent description of why we're doing that. Yeah.
So going between the molecular and the empirical, would you literally just divide it all by two?
It can be like three as well and stuff like that. It's not always two.
Okay. So by the LCD.
That's right. And we'll talk about how you find that and stuff in this section. But yeah, a lot of times it will be a factor of two, but sometimes empirical and molecular will be the same as well. So this is something we'll talk about this section. Good. Other questions?
You did agree with what he said about the LCD.
Let's go a little further before we do LCDs. So hold on.
Oh, I thought you agreed. Okay, I just was trying to understand.
Yeah, let's go a little further into this before. Yeah. Totally. It's kind of, but let's go a little bit further. All right, sometimes I have to tease you guys, I apologize. So. good. All right. An element, sometimes as we've seen, has more than one form that exists as. Carbon is a great example of this. Carbon, if you're writing with a pencil right now, carbon uses graphite. That's what the active ingredient in a pencil is, a crazy thing. There's sheets of carbon, and the sheets supposedly stay on the paper. But diamond, of course, is really famous and stuff in carbon as well, really hard substance, and of course a substance which is worth a lot of money. Newer forms of carbon exist though as well. In the 90s or so, they started to look into Buckminster fullerene, which is a lot of times abbreviated as buckyball. These are basically like soccer balls of carbon atoms that are actually really stable. There's also several versions of these kind of ball versions. Graphene is even a newer form of carbon. Pretty exciting. So I bring this up to show that carbon isn't always just one form, all right? Sometimes it's graphite, which is fine, cheap, really inexpensive. Sometimes you've got diamonds, woohoo, which is awesome if you're a bank person. But then you also have other forms of carbon as well. So the elements sometimes exist as different ones. Technically, an allotrope isn't truly a compound because it's just different ways that the different atoms of an element come together. But a lot of times these allotropes are thrown in as well. There are seven, though, of these special forms that we're going to talk about a lot in upcoming sections, all right? Most of the atoms on the periodic table exist as individual pieces, which we refer to as monatomic. So if you have, for example, helium is just one atom by itself. And if you have sodium is one atom by itself. But there's a silly little expression, and I'd like you to know these seven. These represent the seven diatomic molecules, seven diatomic elements that exist in twos. And you can see here that it's have no fear of ice clear brew. And this stupid expression, and of course the brew is root brew, root beer, not anything else. But anyway, hopefully these will help you remember these seven, which are going to be in different forms. Hydrogen, nitrogen, fluorine, oxygen, iodine, chlorine, and bromine, by default, exist in pairs. You rarely see hydrogen atoms by themselves. You also rarely see oxygen atoms by themselves. They always exist in pairs, these diatomics. So if we're dealing with chlorine, like making sodium chloride, chlorine always comes in pairs, two of them at one time, all right? If you're in high energy places next to the sun or in a lab, yeah, maybe you'll see chlorine by itself, but 99% of the time in chemistry, chlorine will be a diatomic, not a single one. Now, sometimes instructors will use Hankel Brif as a way to memorize those seven, and that's fantastic. There are other expressions to knowing these seven diatomics, but knowing them will be important in stuff that's coming up, so just make a note of them. And again, if it's not on this list, all right, if it's iron, all right, iron is not, have no fear of ice clear brew, so iron would be a monatomic, individual atoms. Most of them are that way, but these seven are so important that it becomes nice to know for future sections.
Fullerenes?
That's right, exactly. That's right. The whole class technically is fullerenes. Well done. That's right. There's all different numbers on them and stuff. So. There's other ones that exist as more than diatomics. Phosphorus, sulfur, oxygen. All right. Phosphorus has a couple different forms. Sulfur sometimes is an eight. There's ozone, which is technically three oxygens, so it's more than the have no fear of ice clear brew, but those are the seven that are so important to us. do not worry about the other ones listed on this site. I just want you to know about them and know that I'm they're not alone, all right? But those seven on that last list, the Have No Fear of Ice Clear Brew, will be important when we start making compounds, because you need to know you're adding two of them and not just one of them. Now, when it comes to making compounds, there's two ways that compounds can come together. And once or twice I babbled about some of this, but I want to kind of formalize it right now. The strongest type of bond that a chemist can make is what's called an ionic bond. And an ion, which goes into an ionic compound, is nothing more than an atom or groups of atoms that have a charge. And you can have charges that are positive, you can have charges that are negative. But if it's positive, that means you're going to be missing an electron. And if it's negative, it means you're going to have one electron or more. So down here in this little picture, I have a sodium atom and a chlorine atom. All right? Now on the periodic table, sodium is number 11. That's the atomic number. And if you remember, the atomic number represents the number of protons. Protons are positive. If the atom is neutral, then it has an equal number of electrons. So sodium has 11 protons and 11 electrons. And likewise, down here, we have chlorine, number 17 on the periodic table. That means 17 protons and 17 electrons. Now, when sodium chloride is formed, table salt, what happens is metals are really good about giving up electrons. And we're going to see that sodium likes to give up one electron. So if it gives up one electron, it still has 11 protons. Remember, if you change the proton number, you change the actual element itself. But now it only has 10 electrons. So if each of these is a positive one, and each of these is a negative one, it's like 11 times plus 1, add that to 10 times negative 1, 11 minus 10, positive 1. This is a sodium ion. We call it sodium plus 1. We're going to write the charges in the upper right-hand corner. We'll see here in a little bit that these are called cations. Cation is a positively charged ion. Now, this little electron is really powerful. The radicals that you guys mentioned earlier, those radicals are really from electrons gone wild. So most of the time, electrons will find something else to react with. And chlorine is a great sink, if you will, for extra electrons. Chlorine, we'll see, loves to take electrons like most of the nonmetals. Chlorine takes one electron. It now has a total of negative 18 charge. It has a positive 17 core. So 17 minus 18, chlorine has a negative 1 charge when it forms an ion. This is a chlorine ion, and we'll see here in a little bit that an anion is when you have a negatively charged ion. So there's a lot of information here. Metals like to give up electrons to become positive. Those electrons usually go to nonmetals, which like to take them in to become negative. A cation, which we'll see formally here in a little bit, is a positive ion. An anion is a negative ion. You had a question.
Yeah, if an atom lost two electrons, it's still a cation, or is it only for one?
You bet. That's right. It would still be a cation. It would be a positive 2 cation then, instead of just a positive 1 right here. Good. And some elements will take 2 electrons. They would still be anions too. They would just have negative 2 for their charge, not negative 1. So notice that in today's lecture, all right, we've seen that the number of atoms will be a subscript on the lower right-hand side, and the charge now will be a superscript in the upper right-hand side. Chemists have each quadrant of the atom done out with something, man, and figuring out how these all go together will be part of the thing of learning this stuff, so. Okay, this is a great place to stop. Have a great day. I will see you this week later on today.